Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the, November 15th, Inclusion, Diversity, Equity, and Access Committee meeting. I'd like to call the meeting to order. Roll call, please, Winter.
Chair Perkins?
Here.
Vice Chair McMichael?
Here.
Regent Arascada?
Here.
Regent Cruz Crawford? Regent Goodman? Regent Tarkanian? You do have a quorum.
Thank you. Regent Goodman, would you like to lead us in the pledge?
Sure.
Thank you.
Okay. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and
justice for all. And with that, I'd like to read our land acknowledgement. Before beginning, we take a minute to recognize that here in Nevada, we stand on the land of the Washishu, Washo, Numu, Northern Paiute, Nui, Western Shoshone, and Nuwu, Southern Paiute. We take a moment to recognize and honor their stewardship that continues into today. With this recognition, we state an intention to rightfully include their voice and respect them as the 27 sovereign tribal nations of Nevada. And with that, I'll move on to item number one, public comment. Let's start with, is there any public comment in Elko?
No public comment in Elko.
Thank you. Is there any public comment in Reno?
Yes, we have some.
Please go ahead.
Good morning, Chair Perkins and Regents. Kent Irvin, ERVIN, past president and director of government relations for the Nevada Faculty Alliance. Thank you for the presentation and agenda item four on equity and compensation. The faculty compensation system at NSHE has been broken ever since merit raises stopped being paid regularly after the Great Recession, now 13 years ago. The Gallagher study in 2018 reported that fixing salary compression issues would require $87 million at that time. That didn't happen. Gallagher also recommended annual updates to salary schedules, and those were not implemented until this fall. If Regents approve the full 11% COLA increase for faculty for FY 2025 at your upcoming meeting, that will only bring average take-home pay in real dollars up to 2016 levels, and they will remain more than 10% below 2009 levels. You can see the new section of the NFA website for more details about that. But that's just to adjust for losses due to inflation. COLAs are important, but across-the-board COLAs do not address salary compression or inversion problems and do not provide rewards for meritorious performance. Some of our NSHE institutions have conducted salary equity studies and some ad hoc salary adjustments have been made. But what we see in analyzing public salary data is that the largest salary increases over recent years have been granted to administrators who are already highly compensated, while rank-and-file faculty are left behind. Also see information on the NFA news section website about that. This is further evidence of a broken compensation system. I would suggest a compensation committee be convened with faculty representation and be empowered to find and recommend real solutions to these issues. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any further comments in Reno?
That's all for now.
Thank you. Any public comment in Las Vegas? Seeing none, any public comment from the phone line?
Not at this time.
Thank you so much. And with that, we'll move right along to the minutes for possible action. Were there any adjustments or corrections to the minutes? Seeing and hearing none, I'd like to entertain a motion.
I move to approve.
Second.
The motion was made by Regent Goodman, seconded by Vice Chair. I'm sorry, I just had a brain burp. Vice Chair McMichael. All in favor of accepting the minutes as written, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
Aye.
Thank you. Thank you. Any opposed? Any abstentions? Moving right along. Thank you for that. Moving right along to the Chair's report. First and foremost, I would like to ask that we take just a minute or so to acknowledge the passing of Audrey James, who was the oldest graduate from UNLV. She passed away at 109. And also to our former assembly man, Harvey Mumford, who also passed during this past month. So just a moment of silence. And thank you for that. The Chair's report. I will be brief. First of all, I want to say thank you to the staff and to the IDEA Council, who are instrumental in helping and supporting and coming up with the brilliant things that go on this agenda. So I'm really happy and pleased to just say thank you. And it's a lot of they do the heavy lift so that we look good up here. With that, I will keep it very brief, and we'll move on to the next, which is the Fairness and Equity in the Workplace Pay Equity for Information Only. I'll be turning it over to a representative from Cindio.
Thank you so much. Okay. Yep. Can you hear us?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much. So thank you all so much for having us here to present on pay equity best practices. We really appreciate your time. If you want to go to the next slide here, we'll talk about who we are real quick. So I'm Dylan Thompson. I'm joined by my colleague, Emma Duesberg. We will be walking you through, in the next kind of 15 minutes, some pay equity best practices. If you want to go to the next slide again, before we just dive right into those best practices, I figured it might be helpful to understand who we are and why we are qualified to be speaking on this. So just a little bit about Cindio. We were founded by Dr. Zev Eigen in 2017. He is both a labor economist and lawyer. He had been doing this pay equity work for a number of years, kind of in the old traditional methods. And a lot of the inefficiencies that he uncovered doing that work have informed the best practices that we will be discussing with you all here today. So with that, if you want to go to the next slide, we'll just talk about some of the kind of pressures and some of the reasons why we're having this conversation with you all. So traditionally, what we've seen with approaches to pay equity, often the work has been done as more of a legal risk mitigation. It's really has been a check the box compliance activity. And you've also seen many, many organizations really just kind of stick their head in the sand and just hope for the best and hope that, they don't get sued. Recently, and when I say recently, it's over the past few years, we've seen a lot of societal and regulatory pressures pushing organizations to go beyond simple risk mitigation and compliance checks. These we've laid out here for you are a few of them, not by any means all of them, but some of the key things that we've seen are senior leaders wanting to really move beyond just risk mitigation and have deeper understanding of the human capital metrics across the entire employee lifecycle, specifically pay equity. And not just understanding what pay equity looks like at a point in time, but truly understanding over time and in real time, what does pay equity look like at any given time within our organization? Second, we've seen employees start to demand more transparency. That's not just around pay, but this is also around things like career progression. Why are pay decisions being made? How are pay decisions being made? What we've seen is when organizations don't have a narrative or a perspective on those things, employees will be filling the void with their own information. And oftentimes that is misinformation because they do not have the full context as to why some of these decisions are being made or how these decisions are being made. Next, we have a lot of regulatory things happening. Of course, over the past few years, we've seen pay transparency laws pass in a number of states. We've also seen pay reporting laws passed in a number of states. we find here at Citio that these regulations are not going to slow down. They're only going to continue to speed up, and more states, jurisdictions will be passing some types of pay transparency, pay reporting types of laws. And then last, but certainly not least, we find companies know that equity is a part of their brand. And not only is it a part of their brand, it's an important part of their brand for the communities that they serve, as well as the talent that they're looking to attract, engage, and retain. And so with that, if you want to go to the next slide, before diving into these best practices, I think it's helpful to understand a few of these, the statistics behind why we find there's a new era of fair pay upon us. As you can see, only 34% of employees believe that their pay is equitable. What are the implications of that? Well, as you can see here, when we find that our pay is inequitable, we have a 15% lower intent to stay. We also have a 13%, we're also 13% less engaged at work. So that means higher turnover costs. That means we're having to backfill these roles more frequently. And even for the employees that are staying, they're less engaged, which means we're getting, you know, less productivity out of them. We're not getting their best work. And so it's really, really imperative that organizations, move to this, what we'll define here in a little bit as this new standard for fair pay. Last but not least, pay-related worries are rising to the top of what keeps employees up at night. This is not going to change anytime soon. As this younger generation continues to enter the workforce, we know that pay is no longer a taboo subject for them. Not only are they talking about each other's pay amongst themselves in private conversations, we also know that they have no problems talking about this in the public sphere, whether that's on Twitter or on TikTok. These conversations are happening more than they've ever happened. And so it's really imperative that organizations really try to achieve this new standard of fair pay that we'll set out here in just a moment. So if you want to go to the next slide, this last thing here is before I turn it over to my colleague, Emma, is just a quick quote from Josh Berson. I'm not sure if you all are aware, but he is a HR industry analyst, pretty well thought of in this space. And he says that it isn't the level of pay that creates employee engagement. It's the fairness of pay. One more statistic from him here that I think is really, really salient. Pay equity is 13 times more important in employee retention and satisfaction than level of pay. So what does this mean? It does not mean that employees always just want more and more money or more and more pay. They want to be assured that what they're being paid is fair and equitable, and not just, again, about getting more money. So if we want to go to the next slide, I'll turn it over to my colleague, Emma, and she'll really lay out for us what this new standard of fair pay looks like.
Dylan, if I can interrupt.
Thank you, Dylan. Sure.
If I can interrupt, are there any questions from the committee? Okay. Thank you. Go ahead.
Sure. And quick apologies. I feel better than I sound, but have a little bit of a sore throat. So I wanted to walk through in a bit more detail. You know, Dylan laid out the why behind the change that we are seeing happen amongst organizations all across the world. But really just to define, what does this new era of fair pay really mean? And ultimately, what we see is organizations shifting from what we would term the old way to the new way. And just to spell out a little bit more of what that change is, you know, where are we coming from? Where are we going to? And also just to, I think, pause and say, for a lot of organizations, this isn't an overnight change. We work with several companies where it's stepping stones from one box to the other to make that change incrementally over time and to really partner to ensure that we're doing it in the right way for them. So the old way that we've seen and kind of what fair pay used to be was very much narrow in scope. We now see it's much more comprehensive when we're thinking about a pay equity analysis. So just to define that a little bit more, narrow in scope, we would mean in terms of the protected categories that we've traditionally looked at would have just been potentially gender, and that's it in the past. Now we see that organizations are looking at gender, race, age, religion, disability, that says the list goes on, to make sure that we're really looking at the full landscape of what's happening in the organization. Another example of this would be compensation. In the past, we might just look at base pay. Now we see more and more organizations looking at bonuses, hourly pay. As our colleagues like to say, there's a lot of skeletons in the closet of these other compensation avenues, and it's super important that we look at it all together to get a realistic picture of what's going on and what inequities exist in an organization. The old way was really focused on mitigation. It was about compliance. Let's do an audit check once a year to make sure that we're in good standing. And then, you know, kind of revisit it 1 year later. Now we're really focused on what's fair. You know, what used to be very much in the arms of legal departments across the U.S., kind of behind closed doors. Now we're seeing compensation leaders, HR leaders, legal really come to the table to say, how do we build equity as part of our business strategy? In the past, we saw this was really an expensive process because we were just repeating the same thing year after year. So, you know, we would look at the issues, run an analysis, see who was paid unfairly, remediate or pay to kind of, you know, make sure that we were leveling it out, and then just hit the same exact issue the year after. What we can do now is, because we can dive into more of the data more readily, we can really get to the root cause. Why are we in this inequitable position to begin with, and make sure that we're getting to the root of the problem to really change what's happening and make sure that we can, you know, be more cost effective in our approach. The last two here that I'll highlight, old way used to be really annual and manual. As I mentioned, it was kind of a once a year compliance check that was done in a more tedious method. So by the time we got the results, they were very outdated. We were making decisions based on, you know, sometimes 2, 3, 4 month old data. Now we can look at using technology, can really look at this data more ongoing and use it as other decisions are being made throughout the course of the year. As we hire, are we doing so in an equitable and fair way? Finally, I mentioned this earlier, but this work used to be very much in the shadows. And I think just the fact that Dylan and I are presenting today means that it's more transparent. More people are asking about what are pay equity practices at organizations. And we're seeing that, you know, companies really have to have at least a commitment and be able to be a bit more transparent about their work. As Dylan said, that is weighing heavily on what is top of mind for employees. So next slide. Thank you.
All right. So thank you for that, Emma, and kind of laying out the old versus the new, the compare and contrast there. So the next question is, how do we actually achieve this new standard for fair pay? Here, we kind of define it within four steps. The first step is show how pay equity is a part of your core values and your business objectives. Second, you really need to be analyzing pay equity in a more comprehensive way. We've already touched on that a little bit. We need to embed pay equity into every pay decision and not just look at this once a year. And we really need to amplify pay equity with more transparent communication. So those are the four steps, and we'll dive into each of those here now. So if you want to jump to the next slide, that would be great.
Yeah, we'll run through these relatively quickly, but I'm happy to answer any questions. But on the next slide, if you don't mind switching, the first one is really showing how pay equity is part of your core values and business objectives. So here's two examples. The one on the left is actually from American Airlines. The one on the right, as you can see here, is from Walmart. So organizations are now really starting to say, hey, we have a commitment to pay equity and making sure that they're building it into, you know, how they're going about their day-to-day, how they're communicating with their employees and ensuring that it's part of who they are. As you can see, I think this quote's really wonderful from Alan Exum. It's about externally competitive and internally comparative. That is how they define fair pay. It's known throughout the halls of Walmart and really part of who they are as an organization. Next slide, and I'll hand it back to Dylan.
And so the next step of this, and Emma's already touched on this a little bit, is really looking at pay equity in a much more comprehensive way than has been done in the past. We can't just be looking at the majority versus the minority grouped up all in one. We really is imperative to be looking at detailed race groups. So again, not just looking at BIPOC as a whole, but looking at all of those race groups in isolation versus the majority. It's also really, really important that we begin looking at the intersections of gender and race. As we know, if you fall into two protected categories, you might be, facing more inequities than others. Think Black women or Hispanic women. They might be facing more inequities than others. And so it's really, really important to capture in your analysis those intersections and those granular details. And then we've noted, too, looking at things beyond just gender and race, we've seen a lot of organizations begin to analyze age. We've seen organizations analyze caregiver status, disability status, veteran status, and then some. I see we have a hand up here. Michelle, I'll turn it over to you for your question.
Regent Cruz Crawford, for the record. Thank you so much,
so
Mr. Thank you so much, Mr. Thompson, for for coming. When I heard about your company, I was really excited to see what you had to offer. In regard to those protected groups within mm-hmm. your organization, who what type of employees do you have that might represent, you know, Black females and what you stated were protected groups?
Are you saying specifically to Syndio or more?
Yeah, to Syndio.
And just so I'm understanding, like the folks that we have internally here that might fall
into those like groups. The diversity of your workforce.
Okay, I don't have like statistics offhand. I don't know, Emma, if you have any statistics as well, but we do have a diverse workforce. We are led by a female CEO. Emma, I don't know if there's anything else that you have in terms of those numbers off the top of your head.
Yeah, we can certainly follow up with more demographic data. It's something that we do track and run our own pay equity analysis, make sure that we're looking at career progression and the pay gap in general and report out on that both to our employees and also publicly. So happy to share that information since it's public for us.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, I'd love to know because, you know, I'm a big proponent. We are here, obviously, in our IDEA team of having representation from all groups to help with the decision making.
Absolutely. Yes. Now we make sure from our board to our leadership team to how we hire to how we, you know, it's what we do with other companies. So making sure that we're doing the same practices internally about what does the demographic makeup look like in our organization. It's a great question.
Yep. Thank you.
Yeah. And we'll follow up with more detailed information on that. And then the last thing here is really it's important to expand the analysis out beyond just base pay. That's a great starting point, and we find it's one where organizations will begin with. But as we know, and as Emma mentioned, sometimes those skeletons are hidden in the closet, and those are often hidden in places like bonus, any other, you know, types of variable compensation that aren't encapsulated into base pay. It's really, really important to go beyond that. And so at the end of the day, the goal for the organizations is that we support is to ensure that across, you know, race, gender, ethnicity, you know, identity, whatever it is, people in their organization are being treated fairly and equitably, no matter what. And with that, we'll go to the next slide.
Yeah, and just a few more thoughts to wrap up the conversation today, and then welcome any questions. The fourth or third point rather is embedding pay equity into every pay decision. So what this practically looks like at organizations that we partner with is step one, truly to run that pay equity analysis to establish a baseline. We're seeing this as table stakes right now. Organizations need to know where do we stand right now and how do we kind of improve from there. It doesn't have to be about perfection. It has to be about progress. So we need that baseline to begin with. Step two, we see organizations then saying, okay, if we have this data, how can we make sure that we're analyzing pay more frequently based on changes that might be happening within the organization, such as a reorg, you know, minimum wage increases. I heard, you know, merit increases, those type of changes. We want to make sure that we're modeling out and understanding the impact that they're having on pay equity within the organization. Third is we're starting to see a lot of organizations analyze market-informed pay ranges and combine that with their internal pay equity. So ultimately what this means is that as we hire people, as we promote, have transfer pay, we want to make sure that we're offering that pay that's competitive, but it's also fair and it's not creating more inequities from occurring. And then finally, we're starting to see a lot of organizations look at their pay policies. You know, we might say that we pay people because of tenure, performance scores, years of experience. Are those policies really working as intended? No compensation team is ever setting up pay policies to be biased, but discretion creeps in over time and our, you know, partnership with organizations is to say, hey, let's look more closely to see if there's, you know, an audit that should be happening and potentially kind of realigning some of those pay policies that we initially began with. I'll hand it back to Dylan to wrap it up here.
If we want to go to the next slide.
Yeah, next slide.
All right. So the last step of this process is amplifying pay equity with more transparent communication. I have the same quote here a couple of times. I think that's just a formatting error, but I think it's really important to hear what Kim Lopu at Walmart has to say. Don't underestimate your organization's appetite for this topic. Be vulnerable, be transparent, talk about the journey that you're on. And I think the key word there is journey. You know, if you've gone through all these steps, you've certainly built the strategy, you've done the underlying work, and it's really important to then communicate that work with your employees and eventually maybe externally as well, too. We find that the organizations that are you know, being accountable and standing in front of their employees and communicating the results of their analysis, even if they're not perfect, they're building trust with their employees because they are not only just sharing where they stand, but they're sharing and you know, sharing those clear next steps as to how they're going to fix any identified inequity. So it's really a trust builder, and you can start to engage your employees even when things aren't exactly perfect. And if you want to go to the next slide, organizations are also going beyond just communicating this internally and externally. You have organizations like UC Irvine who have actually gone out, worked with a third party that would validate the work that they've done. So then in this case, it was the Fair Pay Workplace that validated the pay equity work that they did. I think we oftentimes talk here that if you are, you know, doing your pay equity analysis internally with, you know, maybe a consultant or a law firm, oftentimes there may be the perception from employees that, well, you built the test, you took the test, and you graded the test. So how can we really trust that what you're saying is true? So when you go out and have a third party, like the Fair Pay Workplace, which is, you know, set has a third party board of directors that set out these rules and the standards, it really helps to build that trust with your employees. And I know we started off this conversation with some high level statistics on maybe some of the downsides when employees don't perceive that they are paid equitably or don't feel that they're in a fair and equitable workplace. I think it's helpful to end on some statistics as to what are the benefits of achieving a truly equitable workplace. So through the research we've done, we found that employees who are working in a high fairness environment have 26% higher performance, and they have a 27% lower chance of quitting. So we can kind of reverse some of those statistics that we saw at the beginning. We can lower turnover costs. So we can get more out of the employees that are working with us. And then we find that innovation is actually 6 times higher at organizations that have an equitable workplace culture. So the benefits of achieving, an equitable workplace and the benefits of pay equity are very, very real. And for those organizations that are you know, willing to take these steps to get there. So with that, that kind of wraps up the slides in the presentation that we have, but we would, you know, certainly love to answer any questions that you all might have.
Thank you, Dylan and Emma. We'll really appreciate the discussion. Before I go to questions, I made a chair faux pas. Members of the public may attend the meeting and provide public comment via telephone by calling 669-444-9171 and entering the meeting ID number 928-4944-5069 and the passcode 555-555. And that would take care of it.
Yes, thank you. For the record, Michael Wixom, Special Entity Counsel. I would also recommend, Chair, that you take a moment and reopen public comment at the three institutions to see if there's any other public comment that would be made in light of the statement that was just read, and then that will resolve that issue.
Thank you, sir. Okay, so pause the questions.
Yeah, let's just take a moment and see if there's any other public comment.
Okay. Is there any other public comment via phone? Hearing none. Thank you. And now for the questions. Are there any questions from the members present? I see Regent Boylan. Go ahead, sir.
Madam Chair, thank you so much. Got some nice information there. I had a couple of questions. If you don't mind, bear with me. My first one, of course, is who hired this company? Why and how much were they paid? That's my first question. I still have another. Who did that? Do you know?
Let me clarify. Does this particular company know? To do the presentation?
Yes, ma'am.
They were suggested by a member of this body, and they're doing this out of the kindness of their hearts to educate us all.
I love that. When people do things from the kindness, I just, especially for education, so they're not being paid. I love that. My second question is, what experience do each one of these presenters have in what they were presenting? Nice, easy question. Thank you, ma'am.
Emily, yeah. You can go first.
Sure. So both Dylan and I are on our go-to-market team at Syndio. So we've been at the company for over 2 years, but we represent a larger body of folks that come from a large swath of backgrounds, from legal experience running pay equity analysis and pay equity work at law firms, in-house, to data scientists, labor economists, total rewards practitioners. So we have a deep bench of experts in this space that are continually informing us, informing the public, to make sure that we're kind of up on the latest trends of what's happening.
I meant, what's your experience? Because I saw all your advertising down there. So this really isn't free, because they were advertised, all those companies. What's your experience and the young man's?
Sure. I've been at Syndio for over a little shy of 2 years, but in the HR technology space for well over a decade now.
Thank you so much, ma'am. And the young fella.
Yeah. I've been at Syndio for over 2 years now, and I've been involved in HR technology, specifically the, you know, kind of intersection of equity and engagement for, it would be, I would say, I don't know off the top, maybe like 8 years now. So really my entire post-college career has been involved in the people world.
Outstanding. Thank you so much. Thank you, ma'am. Chair.
Any other questions?
Looks like we got one from
Shelley.
Regent Cruz Crawford.
Go ahead, Regent Cruz Crawford.
Thank you, Chair Perkins, Regent Cruz Crawford, for the record. I did want to say that I recommended the company because I really, well, first of all, my uncle actually used to be a salesperson for the company. He's no longer is, but I remember the conversation that I had with him years ago, like, hey, there's this really cool company. I know you're into equity. And he told me about it. He no longer works with them after I suggested. He didn't work for them at that time. But what really drew me to getting information from the company was their technical space with looking at pay equity. So they have a really, I feel like, ingenious and very forward-thinking platform that takes a lot of the bias out of pay equity, where they put in the numbers and they get projections over time. And last time we had a pay equity study, I asked what type of platform, what type of technology they use, and they said they use some Excel spreadsheets. And so I just thought this was just way more, I don't know, techie, way more advanced in that space. So that's why I asked Chair Perkins, and she was kind enough to fulfill my, I really like when I put a new business on and it's put forward. So I really appreciate that.
Thank you, ma'am.
And I guess I'll follow up with that. The reason I put it on the agenda was because we do these studies every year, and we need to understand that they are very important to retaining and recruiting people to work for Inchi. Any other questions? Oh, wow. Okay. Well, thank you. And thank you very much for your presentation. It was very well thought out and very well put together. Thank you for the information. In closing, I have one final one quick question. What does transparency actually look like? I mean, how transparent can you be when you're talking about people's salaries and disclosing information that they might not want to disclose?
Yeah, that's a great question. It does range for several organizations, but I think on one level, it's just sharing the commitment. Hey, we're taking pay equity seriously. We're doing an analysis. This is how we're looking at the data, and making sure that is shared with your employees all the way. And I'm happy to share after this. We have an article that I had mentioned earlier of how we publicly talk about our pay equity gap. So that'd be kind of cents to the dollars in terms of how, as an organization, we're faring from a pay equity standpoint, as well as the overall pay gap standpoint. So that's also taking into consideration how people might be in different roles that are paid higher than others. So typically it's cents on the dollars metrics with kind of justification as to, hey, this is where we're at now. Here's where we know we have areas for improvement, and here's what progress should look like over time.
Thank you for that. Thank you very much. Very complete answer. Regent Goodman.
Buttons. Thank you. I just had a quick question. I heard you name a long list of different adjectives that basically were qualifications. It's that you said equity, and then you talked about race and sexual orientation and some other things. What is that list of, you know, how do you base your equity? That's my first part of my question. So what is that list? You had several things that you were talking about with equity.
Sure. So that list is what we would term protected categories. So it's kind of by law categories that we should be looking at to ensure that fair pay is happening and that there's not discrimination creeping in. So equal pay for equal work seeped in law to begin with. As we look at protected, we bring in those protected categories. It's ensuring that, you know, gender is not a factor in how we pay people. Disability is not a factor. And that's what our system's helping rule out. Or if we can't rule it out, dig in deeper and to understand what's going on there.
So you have the protected categories. Do you then look at qualifications or how, I mean, I didn't hear that at all in the space. So sometimes a woman's more qualified than a man and vice versa. A man's more qualified than a woman. And, you know, just how do you determine all of that?
Sure. Great question. So we have a full methodology that's really in compliance with the courts and statisticians, but ultimately the first thing is we'd look at, you know, a protected category, which we just outlined, but then it's not unlawful to pay people differently. We just have to make sure it's a justified reason. So then we'd pull in what we would call neutral job-related controls. So that would look like at things such as tenure, experience, or years of experience, rather, performance scores, if that's something that determines how pay is happening. And as long as we can say, okay, we can justify why this person might be paid more than this person over here because of these job-related factors, then that is a viable answer. What our system will help do is, hey, if we apply those, but we still can't rule out that gender, for example, is a statistically significant factor, that's where we'll kind of raise the flag with organizations that we partner with and dig in deeper there.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, great question.
Thank you. Great question. Regent Carvalho.
Thank you, Chair Perkins. Since Regent Cruz Crawford mentioned technology within your organization, can you describe a little bit more in depth what that looks like with the organizations that you work with? Like, is this embedded within their human resources technology, or what does your technology look like?
Yeah. Dylan, if you want to start, I'm happy to chime in.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a combination of how we work with organizations. Often organizations just want the technology and they have the internal expertise to use and leverage our technology to more efficiently run these pay equity analyses. As we noted, the traditional approach of working with, you know, an outside counsel or a law firm or a consultant, it can take a long time. So our technology provides the ability for them to be more efficient and truly embed this into all of the pay decisions that they're making, and you know, look at this more frequently. Other organizations that we work with want to have our team of experts that we talked about. So those legal experts, those labor economists, statisticians, they want to have those folks come in and help support their analyses. So, you know, we would be pulling data from, you know, your technology, you know, whatever your, know, your HRIS data, that's where we'll be pulling the data from and, you know, uploading it. It's a cloud-based technology, but it's up to our customers on how much they want to actually work with our team versus how much they just want to do in-house. And it just depends on the level of capability that you might have internally.
Okay, thank you for that question. Regent Del Carlo.
Thank you, Chair Perkins. Regent Del Carlo, for the record. And I was just wondering, I saw your cross-section of companies on your website, and do you have enough higher education clients to where you can put the higher ed into one category with some measurable results? Thank you.
Yeah, that's a great question. We actually are seeing quite a few higher ed organizations come through and have conversations, partner with us through this work. My mom's been in higher ed for for quite some time and has consistently sent me articles of this is, you know, there's an issue here and you need to talk to them. So it's absolutely something that we an industry that we partner with. I think on one of our slides, we showed UC Irvine as an example of an organization, several other companies that we and universities that we do work with are underprivileged, which means that we just, you know, want to respect that they're attorney client protocol and can't quite share their names, but can share some of the learnings and stories that we've learned from them. But absolutely, higher ed is for sure a kind of subset of the organizations that we work with.
Great question.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay. Well, thank you so much for this presentation. I appreciate your time and I really appreciate your time in the presentation. Thank you so much.
Thank you all. Really appreciate it.
Moving on to number five, INCHI, Equity in Hiring and Retention, Blind Hiring for Information Only. Mr. Williams.
Thank you, Regent Perkins, Chair Perkins, rather. Tillery Williams, Director of Community Engagement, Equity and Inclusion. So over the last several months, we've been discussing this committee, the concept of blind hiring and developing an implementation plan and really, you know, having very thought-provoking conversations, very robust conversations about what that could look like and how that plan could guide a potential future implementation throughout the system. At our last meeting, we heard from stakeholders such as institution representatives from our faculty senates and, we're trying to, I think the committee is trying to figure out things to consider as we do our due diligence in researching and collecting information to help inform this committee's and ultimately the board's decision. Since the last meeting, the chancellor and I had the privilege of meeting with our Human Resources Advisory Council and getting their input and feedback on this concept of blind hiring, but you know, just talking about things that we implement to, or things that we already have implemented to, you know, ensure that we're hiring diverse individuals and that we don't have any biases in our hiring practices. And that meeting was very productive and informative, I must say. One of the most critical questions that I was asked as a staff person who's been charged with researching and bringing back information, what is the problem you're trying to get at? And I think my answer to that was, well, there doesn't necessarily have to be a problem to make sure that we're always being proactive in how we approach and ensure that we are doing work that can pay our employees equitably, help us with hiring diverse workforces and so on. As part of that conversation, the group did discuss both the benefits and some of the challenges associated with implementing some type of form of blind hiring, but I don't think that they were totally against it, but there were some challenges. And one of the things that they stated was that blind hiring could be effective, but it is a tool in a big box of tools that we can use to ensure that we are meeting our DEI-related goals and objectives throughout this system. The group stated that, you know, they are doing many things from an HR and a recruitment and an equity standpoint to make sure that we are paying people equitably and our hiring practices are conducive to folks having a fair shot at being hired and those things like that. So they did say that there are current things within the federal law and the board policy that requires them to have to collect data and report on some of their efforts there at their institutions. But one of the a couple of points that I would like to make when we were having that conversation, some of the main feedback we received centered around two points. One, they said that, you know, that the things that they see is it's really important to provide DEI training to hiring managers and search committee members so that they can be aware of any biases that are out there and you know, when they're going through these searches, try to limit that bias as much as possible. And two, you have to be intentional about creating a search committee or a hiring panel that is diverse in nature. You know, I had a conversation about a year ago with an academic, a faculty member, and was an old colleague of mine. And he said it's very critical that we put together very diverse hiring panels, because they had did some surveys, and what they found was that the very homogenous groups of folks that they had on their panels was kind of leading to some challenges for them, meaning that many of the folks that were, you know, department chairs or, you know, leaders within the systems were folks who were traditional students that had gone through school from the first day of elementary, and they didn't stop until they got their PhD. Well, we don't live in a world anymore to where everybody does that. And there were some biases there because people do have breaks within their education now. They do have kids. They do stop to work. And so they were able to say, you know, the makeup of these committees, something like that does create a bias because they think about the world how they did it, whereas there are people who've done things a bit differently. And so those were some of the things that we talked about. And lastly, with talking to that group, they did show that they were willing to want to come to the IDEA committee meeting, whether that be in the first quarter or second quarter of next year, and provide some updates and to share with this committee things that they are doing that are working well and things that are providing challenges, and inform this committee as we do our due diligence again in researching this concept and figuring out if blind hiring is something that this committee and ultimately the board might want to implement. So I think that marks the end of my remarks, and I will pass it on to the chancellor to see if she has anything to add.
Great. Good afternoon. For the record, Patty Charlton, Chancellor, Nevada System of Higher Education. Director Williams, thank you so much for that update. We do want to share and really focus that conversation with our Human Resources Advisory Group is the first of many of our stakeholder inputs that we had talked about at our last meeting. They had great feedback, and I think they're really looking forward to celebrating and to bringing forward the information to have an open dialogue about the efforts that they're undertaking right now, not just on hiring, but also on retention, because retention is so very, very important in our system. You know, one of the things that we like to see is that you've got employees that are here for 10, 15, 20 or more years. So having that opportunity to see what the challenges are and where we might have policy that might be prohibiting is a great start. And so it's an ongoing dialogue, but it's one that we are steadfast focused on. So thank you.
Thank you for that report. Very thorough. Any questions at all? Mr. Boylan, or Regent Boylan, sorry.
That's okay. I've been called first. Thank you, ma'am. Mr. Williams, and we've talked about this before, not me, I think it was Dr. Robinson or Dr. Kent up north, Kent Irvin. What, and I'm greatly in favor of blind hiring is what we call it, right? I like that, I really do. But how do you do blind hiring when, say, you need to hire a professor or a head of a department, and we have to look up their work, what they have written, what they published. Now we know their names, and we have to. I mean, you cannot just say, okay, this was a no-name person wrote this, and let's claim it's so-and-so. How would that help with our blind hiring idea that you presented that we've talked about before? So can you help me with that?
Thank you for the question, Regent Boylan. Tillery Williams for the record. What I would say is there's no one tool that you can use to get at everything you're looking for. Now, I will say that blind hiring does have its limitations, and that is one of the things that we've talked about previously, that when you're talking about academic faculty, that could be a limitation. But what I would say is there are other areas to where it may be beneficial, like administrative positions and administrative faculty and things of that nature. But to answer your question, yes, that would be that would provide a challenge. And so I think the conversation would be that if we were to implement it and if the board were to go that route, then what would it actually entail and what group would it actually work towards? And as you know, that on an administrative level, those are some of the most highest paying jobs throughout the system. And so, again, it's not perfect, but it's just a tool that we could use if you guys were to decide to use it as a part of the tools that we use to ensure equity and make sure people are having a fair chance of getting looked at and getting interviews.
Madam Chair, if I can follow up.
Sure. Go ahead, Regent Boylan.
Thank you, ma'am. Do I have it up? Oh, yeah, it's on. Thank you for that explanation. If somebody asks me how to answer that question, I have no idea. That's why I'm asking you, because you guys have done this. You've talked to many people. You've talked to people above my pay grade that should know this by now, because we've talked about it quite a few times. So has there been anyone who has a solution to that? Or does the board say, okay, wait, we make an exception for such and such position. We want to blind hiring. You see what I'm trying to say? How do I explain this to my constituents, to my son, to somebody who asks me that? How would I do that?
I'm going to put that to Interim Chancellor Charlton.
All right. Thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you, ma'am.
For the record, Chancellor Charlton, Regent Boylan, just wanted to share that, again, we're at the beginning of this conversation, and we know that there has been ongoing dialogue around how important the importance of removing our bias might be in how we do the hiring processes. I also wanted to highlight the other point that that Director Williams highlighted, is that making sure that our search committee process and those that are participating in the hiring are reflective of our values, and that we're also celebrating DEI in that regard. And so the point that you've raised about being able to look at an applicant and not have some of that body of knowledge that they've produced over their lifetime, that's not going to exist in many cases, and I think we heard that from our faculty. We wanted to start with the Human Resources Advisory Council to really dive into that conversation, and I think as we continue to move forward, as I said before, we are steadfast committed to engaging with all of the stakeholders, including our faculty, including the administrative folks as well, because we want to ensure that the work that people have done that is a culmination of their career is recognized, because there's a lot of value that adds to the Nevada system of higher education. And so it's an ongoing process, and we anticipate bringing this back on an ongoing basis until we know exactly that we've got it right on how we can remove bias and have the most richest and diverse employee base as well as search committee processes. Thanks.
Thank you, Madam Chair, if I can continue. That really doesn't help answer my question. We've been talking about this for a year, and there have been lots of people who've been involved in this, committees and such, and we still don't know how we are going to handle that situation. We are an organization, not one person, two, three, hundreds, thousands, and there are people who know about this. So has anybody come up with an answer? It's not new. We've been talking about this for over a year. So how long does it take for us to get a simple answer to that, if you can somehow tell me?
Yeah. So through Regent Perkins,
no biases.
To you?
I don't like biases. So nope, I'm not worried about bias, but we are doing all that. But when we get to this particular point, we have a habit in NSHE, and I apologize for that, the board, whoever, gets offended. But we have a habit. We don't try to mitigate situations. We wait till they happen. And then we get sued, and we have lots of lawyers, and we still don't get anywhere. So instead of letting that happen, before it comes to that, can we get an answer? This is a university, two universities, R1 rated, but we can't get a simple answer like that in 1 year with all our committees and all our people. That's kind of scary.
So through Regent Perkins to Regent Boylan, I appreciate your frustration with the time that this has taken to bring it forward. I do apologize. This is my second meeting of the IDEA committee. And so I will tell you, as Director Williams shared, we're steadfast committed and we are having ongoing conversations in regards to this point specifically. And so, you know, having that ongoing communication, talking with also the technical side, because we also have to ensure, and I know that we're having conversations with SCS, and rather than having a conversation separately, why don't we just do it all together and get all the stakeholders together? So that's my commitment to you. And I know that Director Williams is also steadfast committed to that. But it is a conversation because we do have one in HR system that supports all of our institutions. And we also have different classifications of employees, as you highlighted. So I'm not saying as an excuse that it's my second meeting, but this is my second meeting. So we'll continue to work forward on this as a strategic priority, and we'll be back at every meeting giving an update if that's necessary and helps to support the work of this body.
Thank you. Director Williams, anything to add?
No, I think that sums it up.
Thank you. Mr. Wixom.
Thank you, Michael Wixom, for the record. I just wanted to make one point with respect to the Nevada open meeting law in response to a question that Regent Boylan put forward when you were talking about region involvement. Under the Nevada open meeting law, blind hiring is certainly permissible. I mean, it doesn't violate the Nevada open meeting law. However, if the board engages in blind hiring for a board officer, for example, the board would have to delegate the entire process to the party that's doing the blind hiring. The board could not participate in the process, because if the board participated in the process, it would violate the open meeting law. So we need to be cautious in that regard. I'm not saying that blind hiring in and of itself is good or bad. That's not my place. But what I am saying is, under the open meeting law, and I did actually confirm this with the Nevada Attorney General's office, the board could delegate the hiring of an individual within certain parameters, but then after it delegated the hiring would take place, and then the person who did the hiring would come back and report to the board. The board cannot participate in a blind hiring process without violating the open meeting law. I just wanted to clarify that point for Regent Boylan.
Thank you, Councilor Wixom. I really appreciate that. Thank you so much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other questions? Excuse me. Any other questions from any members? Thank you for the presentation. Thank you for the update. Next, item number 6, Southern Nevada Diversity Summit for information only. Chief of Staff, Chief of Diversity Officer, Lawrence Weekly from College of Southern Nevada.
Good afternoon, everyone. Madam Chair, Regents, to our Chancellor, and Ms. Chillery, thank you so very much for this opportunity to share with you all. Give you a brief summary. We've been allotted about 10 minutes to give you an update on our past diversity summit. And let me begin by thanking you all for the support that you all provided to us on behalf of our president, Dr. Federico Saragossa. We appreciate you so very much for not only supporting us, but, you know, giving us this opportunity to share just the experiences that we encountered during our opportunity to host this summit. Today, I'd like to introduce you to a young lady who has come to my office, to our office, should I say, as our diversity director, diversity, equity, and inclusion. And she brings 7 years of experience to CSN and to the NSHE system. And she's jumped in with 2 feet, and we're off and running. And then we also have with us today a young lady who she works in the Human Resources Department, Aisha Kitt. Aisha, who has been working with NSHE for a number of years and have participated in a number of the diversity summits. She was a breath of fresh air, actually, when it was our turn to host
she knew because of my limited time at CSN that we weren't really clear on how to host a summit. And so she and her team from CAPE came in, and I got to give her kudos, because had it not been for Aisha Kidd, we would have been out there in a boat with no paddles. How about that? And so with that, I'd like to introduce our diversity director here, Raquel Melson.
Good afternoon. Thank you to the Regents. I wanted to just provide a overview of, for the record, Raquel Melson, CSN, Director of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. I wanted to provide an executive summary, just highlighting the things that happened during the Diversity Summit. Thank you for Aisha Kidd, Associate Vice President of Organizational Development and Effectiveness, overseeing the Center for Academic and Professional Excellence at CSN, for providing this executive summary. Overall, the 14th annual INCHI Southern Nevada Diversity Summit went very well. We had robust sponsorship, which helped us put on an amazing summit this year. Support was provided by multiple departments. We had featured speakers that were interesting, thoughtful, thought-provoking, and timely. We welcomed new elements to the summit. One great element that we really enjoyed was student representation. Each year, we have a president's panel, and this year we added student leaders, some of them representing the student governments or just representatives from the different institutions, were added to the president's panel. We also were able to feature student and faculty music ensembles, and in the evening, we were able to host an executive thought leaders dinner. Attendance, we had 425 in attendance overall at the summit. We did host a summit that was hybrid. So in person, we had 285 attendees, and online, we had 140. Of those attending, CSN had the largest constituency with 166 attendees. Of the larger institutions, UNLV had the smallest contingency with 48. There are 89 unidentified folks who were able to attend online that we are unable to attribute them to what institution, what community partner. Obviously, Dr. Weekly talked a little bit about the challenges that we faced. As CSN was hosting this year, the Office of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion started the year off as a staff of one of Dr. Weekly. And obviously that is not the staffing that you need to put on an entire summit. So Aisha and her team were extraordinary in stepping in to really fill in the gap. I started 2 weeks before the summit. So that was a challenge. That was a challenge. another really strength of the summit, well, another challenge other than low staffing is the funding, the planning was really for 500 attendees in person. And as you heard, we had 285 in person. So that left us with a lot of food, a lot of swag items left over after the retreat, after the summit. We just didn't hit the numbers that we anticipated. And it's, you know, the support from other institutions was particularly low this year. We also found that hosting a hybrid event was extremely challenging with the resources that were available to us. So we hit some of those hiccups with those things online that aren't quite up, they're not able to see, people are having a hard time logging in, the challenges that come with technology. The strength, really the CAPE team, the Center for Academic and Professional Excellence, Aisha's team, they planned and operated a well-put-together summit with their small team. They're small as well, so it's a team of three. But they were able to put together and organize a successful summit. all the folks at CSN that came together, so HR, events, our marketing team, our printing services, OTS, finance, our music faculty and ensemble, all provided support to the CAPE team. Obviously, when I came on board those 2 weeks, I jumped in with both feet and hit the ground sprinting to help with the efforts for those last 2 weeks. In addition, there was a planning committee that did consist of constituents from all of the institutions in the South, and they were essential on the day of, serving as volunteers, helping to get folks where they needed to be. Overall, our sponsors contributed $67,500. The total cost after all the expenditures have been in was $68,852.83. So we came in under budget approximately $18,000, which is extraordinary. I have provided a full summary to you, Chair Perkins, and everyone should have received a copy of this executive summary. So it's been updated since the one that you see. So the numbers that I'm providing are the final numbers. So recommendations for the next summit. Once it rolls back around to CSN, having a fully staffed diversity office so that we can take the reins from CAPE and be able to really do the work that's needed for the summit. We also recommend not hosting a hybrid event. The recommendation would be do a in-person event and then offer maybe a couple weeks later a hybrid that's online that solely happens online, but not to do the two consecutively at the same time. We also recommend possibly moving the summit. Some of the conflict that we ran into is the summit is also on Pride weekend, and so many of our sponsors were torn between attending the summit and really supporting the work at the Pride events. And the last recommendation is possibly hosting at a hotel, somewhere else outside of the campus, a station casino, a Silverton, a non-casino property to make it more accessible. Thank you. And
any questions? And we do have Aisha Kidd who's here with us if we have any other really in-depth questions or any historical questions, Madam Chair, that you all may have for us today. But
thank you and welcome aboard. Thank you for hitting the ground running. That was quite the undertaking for such a short period of time on board with NCHI. Any questions from any members that are here? Regent Del Carlo.
Thank you, Chair Perkins. Carol Del Carlo, for the record. I was there all day. It's probably one of the longest summits I ever attended. I didn't realize I was part of the dinner too, but I have to say, if you were only on board 2 weeks, you couldn't tell. You guys ran a wonderful day. I thought it was very well attended, and I got a lot of information, good information out of it. I always do. I would hope in the future, next year, we get to get more participation from the regents because, I mean, this is what it's about, what we're doing, and this is really how we learn.
We appreciate it.
And I know the spring will be down up north, correct?
Yes.
That's how the schedule works?
Yes. So it'll be in Reno. Madam Chair, you run a meeting today in Reno in the spring. And then next fall, it will be hosted by Nevada State University.
Okay. You had really great speakers. I think that's always the highlight, too.
We did. We had some amazing speakers in.
Especially dinner. Thank you.
Yeah. Dinner was really good. But thank you all so very much.
The dinner speaker, I'm talking.
Oh,
the
dinner
was good, of course.
The dinner was great.
But the
speaker
was
good.
Was really
dinner
excellent.
Was great. But yeah, it was just fantastic. And again, I just want to give kudos to Aisha Kidd. She was amazing and just did a fantastic job. And Tillery, I can't thank you enough. You know, when I was really hitting that discouraged moment, you and Chancellor Charlton just really kind of turned the volume up for us and helped us, you know, kind of just encouraged us and pushed us along. And as I said, again, Madam Chair, you know, Aisha Kidd, and having Raquel come on final 2 weeks, So we appreciate y'all. Thank you for blessing us here today.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Anybody? There's one.
Regent Carvalho.
Yay, thank you. Thank you for your support as well. She's awesome.
Thank you. Thank you. I just wanted to give you props because the work that all of our IDEA council members do at each of our campuses is so important. If the day didn't turn out the way you wanted it to, it didn't seem like that to me. It looked like a major success to me. So I appreciate all the work that went into this. Thank you so much for all of the effort that you put into it. I thought it was a great day. I did not spend the entire day there as Regent Del Carlo did, but what I saw was impactful to me. Your speakers were incredible. And just the time there that I had was really great. So I just as Regent Del Carlo said, I echo that. I hope that all of our regents come to the diversity summits. They are really impactful days for all of us. And I thank you so much for the work that you did. Thank
You're
you.
Welcome. Thank you. For the record, my name is Aisha Kidd. I'm Associate Vice President of Organizational Development and Effectiveness at the College of Southern Nevada. And so I just wanted to comment. I do think it was a very successful day. Overall, it went really well. And having Raquel on board, even for those last, I told, you know, Dr. Weekly that the moment she starts, she's mine. And so that was really important to, I think, the overall success and her and I really divvying up the duties on the day of even. But just from historical, I don't want to throw anybody under the bus, but from historical, our attendance is usually somewhere upwards of 400 in person. And we've not done a hybrid event really for this summit. This is one of the first ones. UNLV, I think, did one last year. I think they did host a portion of it online. And it's difficult to do a hybrid, but I would really like to see all of the institutions really participate at a high level, regardless of whether they're hosting or not, to really be able to not only market it, but to just really encourage people to support the summit by coming out and doing that learning and sharing with each other. I think that's incredibly important. And we gave a 2-page list of recommendations to Nevada State so that they could, you know, and we are going to provide our support to them next year as part of the committee. And the committee was incredibly helpful with their ideas and their support and on the day of. And so we appreciate all of that. I appreciate, you know, your support for coming out to the event. And for just supporting the IDEA committee and the things that are happening under DEI. So we appreciate y'all. I know that, I think.
We went over, Madam Chair, what's up?
Stop. It was important work.
Thank you.
There's a lot of information to give out to us. So thank you. I appreciate it. For reference, you mentioned the Northern Nevada Summit. It's actually going to be on February 22nd at UNR. Okay. The invitation should be going out shortly because they just decided decided the date and today. So and any other questions, comments? Oh, Shelley. I'm sorry, Regent Cruz Crawford.
Regent Cruz Crawford, for the record, that just shows that we're very comfortable with each other. Mm-hmm. I wanted to say that I got to attend the conference, and I just have to say I only got to attend 2 sessions and the dinner. Because I was working. Luckily, my school's 8 minutes up the road. And the first session I attended was a mentorship session for specifically Black students and Black professors. And the staff that works at CSN that was presenting were phenomenal. They were sharing their personal contact information to really grow the mentorship, and I really appreciate it. And then I attended the TRIO presentation by Noah Walls at UNR, and I got so much information, and then I got to help actually present to some of his students later on. So I just want to thank Ms. Melson and, of course, Ms. Kidd and Dr. Weekly for putting this together. I know I put together a DEI summit that's actually in the North and the South for the Guard and hybrid. So I totally get your frustration, and if there's anything that I can do to support, even if it's something, because we, General Barry's direction for the Guard is very much DEI, if there's any, like, partnership that we can support with. I would love to, even if there was a presence, I would love to combine forces or even outside of the guard, if there's anything I can do, because it was really impactful. So I did have two questions. The first one was, how many summits have we had before this? I didn't know if this was the first one.
So it's at least 14 before, this is the 14th one.
Got it. Okay. And then I know Ms. Melson said that she said it differently. She said that she came $18,000 under budget. So I didn't know if that was a mistake or if that is correct.
Correct.
Yes, correct.
Is
correct.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. I was like, what? Okay. Awesome. So anything that we could do even as a committee, idea committee with, I think once people are in the doors, they love it. So anything we can do for PR with it, even if it's a think tank, I'm sure your recommendations are great. I'd love to support because it's meaningful work. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Excellent suggestions. Thank you so much. Any other questions? Comments? Thank you again. Good job with that. Okay. What's next? Oh, campus updates from the Idea Council. Who is going to do them? Oh, Angela. Is she there?
I'm here.
Okay. Idea Council campus activity updates for information only. Angela Holt, I will turn it over to you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's great to be here today. I have a lot of wonderful updates happening at your institutions that I'm happy to share. I'll start with Western Nevada College. I am Angela Holt. I'm the Director of College and Career Readiness at Western Nevada College, and I serve as the Chief Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Officer as well. Thank you. At WNC, we have some very exciting things happening surrounding the DEI sphere. We are presenting a movie called The Most Dangerous Year. That will be on November 28th. It will be hosted by the Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Committee. It is to honor the Transgender Day of Awareness, and that date is actually November 20th. But on that day, we are also hosting an LGBTQIA+ training with Kyle Weiss from Truckee Meadows Community College, and all of our faculty and staff are welcome to attend that training. We also hosted a Dia de los Muertos altar competition. There were 5 ofrendas or altars that were hosted by the Latino Leadership Academy, with different departments on campus participating, and the associated students won that competition. We had a Diwali celebration this week. It was the first Diwali celebration that we had hosted on campus, and that was hosted by my department of College and Career Readiness. It was a lot of fun. We were able to celebrate the Festival of Lights and bring some awareness to a different tradition on campus. Then moving on, College of Southern Nevada. They are currently in the process of hiring an undocumented student programs coordinator. They are hosting International Student Week this week on campus. The week is November 13th through the 17th. They celebrated last week on November 8th. They had a week-long celebration of activities for first-generation college students. They anticipated about 300 attendees and ended up with over 439 attendees. So they had a very successful event. They were excited about that. Nevada State. They celebrated the opening of their multicultural collective in August of 2023. And to date, they have had over 600 visitors into the space. So also another successful and exciting activity happening. They welcomed their largest Dream US cohort this fall semester, and their anti-racism task force just completed its report and has submitted recommendations to executive leadership. Great Basin. Great Basin recently hired a tutor in their academics success center who specializes in assisting English language learners, and they will be hosting the LGBTQIA+ Train the Trainer session in early December. UNR, they have quite a few announcements. Firstly, Dr. Angela Moore is no longer with the university as of November 3rd. She was serving as their director in the Office of Equity and Inclusion, and they are working to place an interim director. The Northern Nevada Diversity Summit, as we have just talked about, is scheduled for February 22nd. Counseling Services hosted an event to celebrate Transgender Week of Visibility. The Multicultural Center Director, they just wrapped up their search this week and will be having on-campus interviews for that position. They have a very full calendar of events for Native American Heritage Month. They will be November 28th coming up on PBS, Native America Screening and Discussion with the JCSU Wells Fargo in the JCSU Wells Fargo Auditorium from 5:30 to 8:30 p.m. On November 30th, they have a land acknowledgement dialogue, and that location is to be determined. And lastly, Wolfpack Athletics will honor Native American Heritage Month at the following home games. The men's basketball versus Portland game on November 18th at 6:30 p.m. Women's basketball versus Oregon on November 21st at 7 p.m. And football versus Wyoming on November 25th at 6 p.m. Lots of great things. DRI, they recently distributed their annual inclusion and belonging survey. The input they receive helps shape continued improvements in inclusion and belonging, informs practical recommendations, and enhances activities related to positive organizational culture. This is key to the recruitment and retention of a diverse workforce. Employee input from previous years has helped to drive expansion of employee recognition programs, collaboration support, networking events to build workplace community, leadership training, and professional development funds for their technologists. In June, DRI's IDEA Committee invited speakers Stephanie Farrell and Bryce Hughes to share and discuss their book, Queering STEM Culture in U.S. Higher Education. It was a great talk and highly informative. In October, DRI's IDEA Committee hosted a Day of the Dead celebration. In addition to learning about this Mexican tradition, DRI staff helped put together traditional ofrendas, or altars, to honor their deceased loved ones. They did this in person at both of their campuses and hosted a virtual altar for those who chose to attend online. It was also well received, and they expect this to become an annual event. Truckee Meadows Community College. They are bringing back their UndocuAlly training. Michelle McCauley Bobadilla is TMCC's new Native American Indigenous Student Advocate, and she will start on November 20th. TMCC also had a Dia de los Muertos community altar and 2 days full of activities such as the showing of the movie Coco. They had Pan de Muerto with, I'm not going to be able to pronounce this, Champurrado, and arts and crafts. So I apologize for butchering that. UNLV, they are having also a first generation week of programming, a symposium with the Office of the Intersection, an undocumented student program hosted Unspoken Words events focusing on undocumented student communities. And they are having UndocuAlly trainings with spring events scheduled. And that is all of the institution updates.
Thank you very much. That was a lot of updates. I'm happy to see that our institutions are busy out there promoting diversity and equity. Any questions or comments?
Regent Cruz Crawford?
Go ahead, Regent Cruz Crawford.
Sorry, I didn't know if you saw my hand. Thank you, Chair Perkins. Question, I didn't see an attachment on the board docs. Are the celebrations or events coming up, can we get those on our calendar?
Yes, I believe we can share that information. I will get with Tillery and we can get the dates so that it can be posted.
Yeah, because if we get it on our events calendar as regents, it's a lot easier. to RCP. Thank you.
Thank you.
Great suggestion. Any other questions or comments? Now moving on to item number 8, new business. Is there any new business? Go ahead, Regent Goodman.
Thank you. I have an item for new business. I'd like to ask for an item to be placed on the next agenda mirroring the resolutions passed by the United States Senate and the United States House of Representatives. I see this resolution as a reflection of our condemnation of anti-Semitism on campuses. This resolution passed unanimously in the United States Senate, and I just wanted to read a few pieces of this, and I'd like to then provide it to the record.
That has not been agendized, so...
It's not agendized. It's just what I want for my new business item.
It's the wording for your new business item?
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, so... It is, whereas freedom of speech and expression are foundational principles of institutions of higher education in the United States, but when these principles are used to promote violence, hatred, or discrimination on the basis of religious beliefs, national origin, or ancestry, higher education leaders have the right and an obligation to respond. There's more here that states that the United States Senate strongly condemns any instances of anti-Semitism occurring at colleges and universities in the United States, encourages higher education leaders, including presidents, deans, and administrators, to publicly condemn speech that incites or celebrates violence against any people based on religious beliefs, national origin, or ancestry, and encourages institutions of higher education to engage with Jewish student organizations and ensure that Jewish students, faculty, and staff can pursue their academic and personal aspirations without fear. I will submit this document to the record so that it can be part of that next agendized item, and that's what I wanted to say.
And so, Michael Wixon, for the record, just for purposes of clarification, that's the item that you want as new business on the next agenda, that language?
Yes.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other new business? I was looking back to see if there was something mentioned earlier, but I think we covered all those subjects. So with that, I'll take us to the second public comment, and I will not make the faux pas twice. Members of the public can attend and provide public comment or testimony at these sites. Public comment may also be offered via telephone by calling 669-444-9171 and entering the meeting ID number 928-494-5069 and the passcode 555-555. And with that, I'll any public comment in ELCO?
There is no public comment in ELCO.
Thank you. Any public comment in Reno? And state your name and spell your last name for the record.
My name is Amy Payson, P-A-S-O-N. And I'm faculty at UNR, and I'm currently the Faculty Diversity Committee Chair. I just want to reiterate that UNR faculty are committed to diversity in hiring, and we have spent many years honing our own policies and practices to ensure that we are checking for implicit bias, checking the candidates that we have in our search, if necessary, interviewing more candidates than just a top 6 or top 3 to ensure that diverse candidates are part of our pool. We are currently working through updating our policies and practices to do the very things that you're attempting to do with exploring anonymized review. What I do want to say is that searches and hiring is the domain of the faculty, and so I want to make sure that unless it's something like a chancellor search where the board has direct responsibilities in terms of hiring policies and practices, that you need to leave it up to the faculty to do the searches for our faculty. We have policies and practices at UNR. It's in our university administrative manual, as well as other policies specific to executive searches in our university bylaws. The regents do not have authority over our bylaws or university administrative manual. So we are doing our best to hire diverse faculty. So I just want to be clear that as we're having these discussions, that there is a limit to what you all oversee as regents. The other item I wanted to address is just with equity in our pay. I'm probably going to take the thunder of my colleague from UNLV, is that we do have university experts and we do have faculty at our campuses who have done the comprehensive equity studies at our own campuses. And so please listen and hear the lessons that these faculty have in regards to this. It's great that we're looking to external folks, but Walmart is not the same as a higher ed institution. The last comprehensive equity study that we did, which was limited in scope that I'm aware of, I think it was in 2018, what we did notice is that it's really hard to do equity studies with the kinds of faculty that we have on campuses. Any administrative faculty on our campuses will tell you that no two people have the exact same job description. So it's really hard to make comparisons. As we're doing our comparisons with academic faculty, there's a million other factors besides those protected classes that we have to figure in. People who have grants or fellowships or who do entrepreneurships, who have patents, who are doing other consulting work that have extra compensation, that's part of it. It gets really complex. So if you are looking at trying to get some software, just recognize that it's not just a matter of inputting numbers. What we do need to have is some standardized equity policies that our campuses do not have, so faculty can get their salaries looked at. So it's a very complex situation, so I hope you consider these as you move forward. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Kent Irvin, ERVIN, Nevada Faculty Alliance. I did appreciate the presentation from Sendayo. It can be useful, valuable to get input to find out what expertise and technologies is available in the marketplace. But to be clear, that was a sales presentation. And if you, if ENSHE wants to go down a path of doing some of this kind of work, of course there would be a competitive request for proposals where you would look at multiple companies and find out their expertise and price, and particularly their expertise in higher education. As my colleague just said, that's very important that they that we recognize the differences in higher education. They had a slide that said 34% of employees believe their pay is equitable. Or inequitable, I think it was, inequitable. That would be great if only 34% of our faculty employees thought their pay was inequitable. In our survey from fall of 2022, 71% of academic and administrative faculty disagreed with the statement that their compensation is appropriate compared with others in their field and stage of career nationally. And 66% disagreed with the statement that considering their performance and years of service, that their compensation is appropriate compared to other hires at their institution before or after them. And 52% were seriously considering leaving or had considered leaving within the past 2 years. Now, if faculty employees don't receive the same cost of living adjustment as other state employees when you meet next and at the end of the month, I think that number of 60 to 70% won't go down as far as folks believing their pay is inequitable. And I gave a bunch of percentages. I have one more, 50%. 50% is the pay increase the colleague I just learned about this week who is leaving the university to a private firm, that's her pay increase that she'll get by moving away from higher education. Thank you.
Is that all? Any more public comment in Reno?
That's all for now.
Thank you. Any public comment in Las Vegas?
Dr. Bill Robinson, Chair of the UNLV Faculty Senate. First, let me apologize for my phone. Second, let me say ditto to my colleague from Reno. She and I think alike about all this stuff. Aside from the fact that, yeah, we could have done today's study with our own internal people and some of the studies we need to do. The Gallagher study from 2018 was really poorly done, and it still came up at $90 million. I mean, it compared NSC to community colleges and based the description on that. It compared UNLV and UNR to Cal State's, not to the UC campuses, and it still came up with $90 million. I would remind you that, again, our base budget from state general fund this year is where it was in 2009. That's $60 million a year from UNLV that we would have gotten if we had just stayed even as a percentage of the state budget, $60 million. The dealing with equity, just to be realistic, there's only one source of funding if you want to deal with this equity problem, and that unfortunately is not where we want to go, which is our students' pockets. And somehow we have to deal with this with the legislature and with our students and how we fund things, because we're not going to solve this problem just by sitting around in a meeting and going to the legislature and saying, please, somehow there's got to be a better plan to solve the problem than we're going to have. Right, it's just too huge a problem, and the legislature has not indicated a willingness to deal. And this is just the economist in me. The other side of this is the campus climate part. So we know that climate on our campuses is not nearly what it should be. We know that in particular, female faculty and faculty of color do not feel the same about the campus as people who look like me on our campuses. We know that if we hire women and people of color, they are far more likely to leave than people who look like me. And let me just say that when we do planning in the ENCHI, your planning rig process leads campuses to produce plans that talk about all of this wonderful new stuff we're going to do, when it should in large part be talking about the real, substantive, serious issues that exist on that campus and the real, substantive, serious ways that campus is going to deal with those issues. And when the board is not asking the campuses to really talk about what those issues are and how we deal with them, then, right, it makes it less likely that we're going to do that. So I'm going to urge you to update your planning process idea with the campuses to help deal with this.
Thank you. Any further comments in Las Vegas? Any comments on the phone? I'll take that as a no.
Did she ask?
Thank you. And with that, we are... I read it at the very beginning. No, I mean, I read it just like 8 minutes ago. right after I opened the public comment. Do you want me? Well, thank you. And with that, we are adjourned.